I'm John Hodges, and this is the talk about the birth of the West. I thought it would be, in a conference on identity, one of the largest identities that we consider is our civilization. Who are we and where do we come from in terms of a civilization? And so Jock asked me to talk a little bit about what we do at the Center for Western Studies. I run an organization called the Center for Western Studies, and we run a gap year program for kids who want to take a year off between high school and college to study two things: a Christian view of the world and the history of Western civilization through the arts, through the humanities. So we talk about all the literature and music and art and philosophy and architecture and that sort of thing that embody and convey the elements of what it means to be a Western thinker. There's a whole lot going on there. And so we thought it would be fun to talk about how it is that this Western civilization came into being. The typical explanation that you get usually is that we are the result of a sort of amalgamation of two civilizations. The civilization that grew up around the Greeks in the 4th century, 5th century BC, and beyond, and the Jewish Christian civilization that came out of Jerusalem. And the two of these civilizations are embodied in the cities that symbolize them. C'est pas moi. Not me. Those two cities are Athens and Jerusalem. You hear that all the time. Athens representing the Greeks, Jerusalem representing the Judeo-Christian side. And Athens and the Greeks are associated with philosophy and reason. And then Jerusalem is associated with revelation. And those two have, for the better part of our last 2,000 years, those two things have been understood to have a relationship to each other. Some disagreed. Tertullian famously said, what does Athens to do with Jerusalem? What does Jerusalem have to do with Athens? The two are separate. But most of the people have engaged the two together in some fashion or another. It's not me. It's something else, you guys. I'm sorry. The question is always, how do we relate these two together? Well, the history of Athens, the reasoning side of this equation, it comes to be known to us through the city of Rome, because, as you know, the Greek world was conquered by Rome in the 2nd century BC, and the Romans adopted a great deal of the thought of the Greeks, much of their artwork, much of their philosophy, inspired them. Well, the city of Rome then becomes a place, and the civilization of Rome becomes a place through which we understand our Greek heritage. But it seems like it's the same city, Rome, that interprets for us Jerusalem as well, because, as you know, the Christian Church moves quickly to Rome, among four other cities. The early church was made up of five cities, maybe you remember, Rome being one, but also Antioch and Jerusalem and Constantinople and Alexandria, those five cities. And in the great schism that happened in the 11th century, four of the cities went east and one stayed alone in the west, and that was Rome. So what we consider to be, let me clarify something. When I talk about Western civilization, I'm talking about including the east, the Eastern Christendom, okay? Now, I'm not making a distinction between Rome and Constantinople. I'm making a distinction between the West and Hinduism or Buddhism or any of the other Eastern thought. But there was a schism even amongst the Westerners, weren't there? The Eastern Church went one way and the Western Church the other. And so for the the history of the Western part of Christendom, Rome becomes the way to understand it, right? I wonder if it's...
I told Jack, so I think they might be working on it.
That's maybe what they're doing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's happening here. I move things around as it doesn't make any difference. So you're maybe right that they're working on it. Yeah. Sounds like they're very busy in the attic. So what we've got are two cities that are... Athens and Jerusalem. Here's a picture of the two, Athens on the left and Jerusalem on the right. And how those two cities are interpreted for us through Rome. My thought is that this is correct. First of all, this is true, but it's not the whole story. I would like to posit that God himself actually created Western civilization. Now, of course, he created everything, so Western civilization is just one of those things, right? But I want to talk about how specifically he brought about this combination of these two things. He did so through the person of Paul. If you know, Paul is the apostle to the Gentiles. If you think about the Acts chapter 9 story, where Paul is... has been persecuting the church, right? He stood by and watched Stephen be stoned. He was arresting and persecuting Christians right and left as Saul of Tarsus. Well, he is confronted by Jesus himself in a supernatural event and thrown off of his horse in Acts 9 and blinded. And when he's blinded, he hears Jesus tell him to go to the city and meet a fellow called Ananias. And that's his job. They have a conversation. Paul says, "Who are you, Lord?" And God himself says, "Why are you kicking against the goads? Why are you persecuting me? Why are you trying to stop me? I'm Jesus, the one that you've been persecuting." Well, this was a shock and astonishing to him, of course. And as a blinded man, he went into the town, and God himself spoke to this Ananias, and he said to him, "I want you to heal a fellow for me. He's blind. His name is Saul of Tarsus, and he's blind, and I want you to heal him." Now, if God appeared to me and told me he wanted me to heal somebody, my first thought would be, heal? How do you do that? You know, what do I know about that? But that wasn't, strangely enough, that wasn't Ananias' response to God. His response was to sort of knock his knees together, you know, and say, "Do you mean Saul?" Because this is the guy that had been oppressing everybody, right? He's scared to death of this guy, rightfully so. So he says, "Well, how can you ask me to do this thing? You know, what's going on?" And God's response to him is very interesting. He doesn't say, "Don't worry, I've taken care of him. He's not going to hurt you." Or it doesn't sort of salve him in any way that way. What he says to him is this. He says, "This is the guy that I've prepared to take the gospel to the Gentiles." That's it. Wow. So, sure enough, that's what happens. Not to go any further in the story, but that's what happens, right? He comes and he's healed of his blindness, and suddenly Saul becomes Paul and goes about doing the work that God has called him to do. Now, what I want to talk about is how it is that God prepared this fellow Paul to be the apostle to the Gentiles. What do we know about him? Well, we know... Oh, wait, I'm ahead of myself here. I'll tell you in a second. We know that he was trained under Gamaliel, who was a famous Jewish scholar. So he became a Pharisee of Pharisees. He was sharp as all get out in accordance with the Jewish law and the Jewish traditions. And so he was a Jew of Jews, as he said later on. He was a Pharisee of Pharisees, he told us. And interestingly enough, as a side issue, later on he says, those things meant nothing to me after I became a believer. That was not something to put my identity in, you know. But that's what he said. He recognized himself as a Jew of Jews. He knew, in fact, he said, I kept the law perfectly, which is an astonishing thing to say. Well, so he was a Jew. He knew the Jewish traditions well, knew the prophecies well. Well, he also was able to speak Greek. He was able to rationalize in Greek. He clearly had been taught Greek logic at some point and rhetoric. Because if all you've got to do is read his letters to see his thinking, his way of thinking, placing reason at a very high position in his life. So he was, his training in Greek language and logic and so on, and his training in Jewish Phariseeism were both brought to him, given to him, part of his life long before he became a Christian. So God was preparing him long before he was ready to send him on the route for the route he had intended for him. And I'm going to argue at the very end that that's how you are too, and I am. That each of us has been prepared even before we've become Christians. In many cases, I didn't become a Christian until I was 25. But I was prepared in a whole lot of things before I became a believer to be able to do the work that God has given me to do. And I think it's just the way he does. He has plans for you that you don't know about. And that's a great thing. So here he is, though. Here's Paul with all this learning in both the Jewish camp and the Greek camp. And so he himself becomes an embodiment of both Athens and Jerusalem in one person. Do you see? And not only in one person as a Jew who happened to know Greek, that was still a separation within this one person, but as a Jew who knew Greek who became a Christian. And so now both the Jewish world, his Jewish world and his Greek world are interpreted for us through his newfound faith, through his new life as a new person in Christ. His identity is built up of these various things, but then that identity is solidified into one identity, if you will, that becomes the gospel that he then preaches to the world, to the Gentiles. So he himself is an embodiment of those two things. But beyond that, I think it's interesting to see just how it is that he went about fulfilling this call to be the apostle to the Gentiles. He went off and studied for a while on his own, first of all, and he went and spoke at length with the other Christians in Jerusalem to kind of get acquainted and to get his story straight with them. All that had to be of a unity. And then he went on his missionary journeys. Now, you know, we talk about three different missionary journeys that Paul went on. A fourth, if you want to take the last route he did to Rome and his preaching in Rome. But three circuits of missionary journeys before he went to Rome. And I'd like to bring your attention to the second one. This is a map, if you can see it, of the Middle East in the time of Paul. And this line that you see here is the line that he took on his second missionary journey. He started here in Antioch, up in Syria, and he went into what we call Asia Minor. Tarsus, there's the big town of Tarsus. Tarsus was a big city at the time. And then further west to Derbe, to Lystra, to Iconium, you see Antioch, Mysia, Troas, and so on. Well, let me show you the verses in, this is Acts 16, that describe this first part of the journey. He says, they passed through the Phrygian and Galatian region after being forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. After that, they came to Mysia. They were trying to go into Bithynia, and the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them. And passing by Mysia, they went down to Troas. Now look at this map again. Can you see the arrow here? He's heading up for Antioch, and he goes into Asia Minor. And it says that he wanted to go into Asia proper, which would be to the east. It would be this way. And God stopped him. Now, he doesn't explain how. It just says he did. We don't know how. But, so he goes on further west. He heads west this way, up into Mysia. Here's Mysia, you see. And he wants to go into Bithynia. Now, Bithynia is north and east, you see, up here. But the Spirit of Jesus, it says, stopped him. So he goes down further west to Troas. Now, what I want you to see is, from Antioch, he's basically going west. He heads west. Now, he gets to Troas. After being stopped from wanting to go east twice, he makes it to Troas. Troas is a city right on the sea. And in Troas, in Acts 16, we read about a dream that he has. You remember the dream? He has a dream that a man from Macedonia says, come over here and help us. And he interprets that to mean he should come over there and preach the gospel in Macedonia. Well, take a look at the map. Macedonia, here they are in Troas, right here. Well, Macedonia, is over here. See Macedonia over here? What direction is that? West. So it says, in a vision they appeared to Paul in the night, a man of Macedonia standing and pleading with him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. When he had seen the vision, we immediately sought to leave for Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. This was a dream calling them to preach the gospel in Macedonia. So, what he does is that they set sail from Troas. We ran a straight course to Samothrace, and on the following day, it's an island in the middle of the Aegean, and the following day to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city in the district of Macedonia, Roman colony. Macedonia was a Roman colony. Look again at this map. He's gone this way and wanted to go east. No, God told him. No, God tells him. So he continues west to Troas and has this dream. In Troas, he's called to go west to Macedonia. So he does. And he sails. By the way, interesting little tidbit is this is the first time you see in this book of Acts the writer saying, we. Did you notice that? We did this. Well, that's when they think that's when Luke joined him. So now Luke, the writer of Acts, has joined him, and he's sailing with Paul to Macedonia. So they go to Macedonia. They go to Philippi. They meet Lydia. Do you remember Lydia? And they preach there and further south in Macedonia, down through the Aegean, down to Athens, which is down here. And this is the famous Athens chapter in chapter 17, where he speaks in Mars Hill, you see. So he speaks he tells them about the unknown God. He leaves from Athens and he heads to Corinth. You see Corinth here? That's Corinth. From there, they sail to Ephesus. They sail back to Israel and to walk to Jerusalem, march to Jerusalem. So that's the journey. Antioch, Troas, down Macedonia to Athens, Corinth, Ephesus. Here's the Ephesus, stop in Ephesus, and then back home again. Well, it turns out the third missionary journey is almost exactly the same. He goes out of Antioch, heads across to Troas, never mentions in that case that he wants to go east. He only thinks west. He goes to Troas, back across through Samothrace. Oh, by the way, I think I have a... Have you ever been to the Louvre Museum? Anybody been to the Louvre? Yeah? Do you know the Nike? It's the top of the stairs. You know that Nike? It looks like this. Up close, it's this Winged Victory, they call it, the Nike. It's called the Nike of Samothrace. I put it in here just because that's the island they found it on. It was rebuilt. It was in pieces, but they put it back together again. It was probably carved in the Hellenic period around 200 BC, something like that, which means it was two centuries plus before Paul arrived at Samothrace. Just just to give you a little sense of time. So, in the third missionary journey, he goes across, back across to Samothrace and Philippi, Macedonia, down to Athens and down to Corinth. Now, in Corinth, in his third journey, he writes the letter to the Roman church, what we know as the Book of Romans. And if you know your geography, you know from Corinth, Rome is to the west. Right? So he's thinking west. And if you know the Book of Romans, you know that at the end of Book of Romans, he talks about wanting to go to Spain. Spain is even further west, isn't it? So here's my thesis. God prepared this guy way before he even knew he was going to become a Christian to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. He's the perfect guy to do it. And then, on the missionary journey that he went, he was guided by the Spirit of God, it says, by the Spirit of Jesus, in the direction west. That's what happened. And then, once he had that dream in Troas, he never thinks about going east again. His mission is to the west. His mission is westward. Now, I think it's perfectly reasonable to argue that you and I, sitting right here, right now, in this conference, are here partly because he obeyed that dream in Troas. Because his work went west, and Europe for the next 1,000 years is under the Christian Church housed in Rome, and the Reformation, of course, happens in the 16th century, and that divides the authorities, but still is a Christendom, as it were. And then in the next following 5 centuries, you see all of the colonization of the United States, South America, North America, Australia, India, colonies in Africa. And with them, for better and worse, I'm not arguing it was all perfect, but for better or worse, the faith went with them. It just did. And that means that the influence of the faith on this country and my ancestors and my brothers and sisters led me to being able to be a believer and talk to you today. I think you can actually trace it all the way back to that moment. If when he wanted to go east and God said, no, I don't want you to go east, and he disobeyed, we'd have a different world. Or if God said, no, I don't want you going west, I want you going east, it might be that the Saudi Arabian Peninsula would be where the faith began and ran on, you know, and further east into India. We believe that we have tradition that some of the disciples went to India and preached there. Certainly they went north into Eastern Europe and into Russia eventually in the next few hundred years. But it would be a different world today if he had done differently, if he hadn't gone to Troas and had that dream and moved to the west. So, and I've told you already, I think, about who Paul is. The references I'm using for that from Acts 22, he says, I am a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up to this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers. And then we have these two verses that describe the depth of his Greek thinking and his ability to speak to those who were not Jews. He's in Acts 17, he's saying, the God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made by hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. You see, it's not an argument from Jewish tradition. It's not an argument from the Jewish law or prophecy. He's not saying we're fulfilling any prophecy with this. He's reasoning with them, in a sense, in accordance with their own Greek philosophy and logic. You didn't create yourself, he's saying. You owe your creation to someone else. Who is that? We haven't discussed that yet. But the person that you owe yourself to is not can't be somebody who needs you to take care of him. He wouldn't have created you. He wouldn't be the creator that we're talking about if that were the case. He himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. He made himself one man, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might feel around for him and find him. And that's exactly what these philosophers had done. He walked through this group of statues of all these gods that the Greeks worshipped, and found, of course, that one statue to the unknown God, and then says, I'd like to tell you about him. But they recognized that there had to be something going on here. The Greeks recognized that before, without any direct influence from Jewish prophets. If perhaps they might feel around for him, okay, right, he's not far from each of us, for in him we live and move and exist. And even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his descendants. There's another bit of evidence that he's very much aware of the Greek traditions and Greek literature and language. He knows their thinkers. We ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by human skill and thought. It has to be something that is bigger than that, something more than that. You know, at the beginning of John's Gospel, he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And that word for God there, of course, is Logos, right? The Word he's talking about, and we translate it, the Word. Well, the Greeks, John knew very well who he was talking to, and when John spoke to them, he said, I want to talk to you about the Logos that you know well. Socrates used that word. Plato used that word, the Logos, to talk about the God. Well, so it wasn't at all surprising or difficult for the Greeks to understand that in the beginning was the Word. The problem the Greeks had was about 12 verses later when John says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That's when they say, check, please, I'm out of here. That's nuts. That's crazy talk. The God that holds everything all together, the God that created everything out of nothing, that kind of God became a person? That's impossible. And I think that's one of the reasons that Paul says later on that the gospel is foolishness to the Greeks, because they really did have trouble with the embodiment of the Logos. In chapter 17, you also have, so having overlooked the times of ignorance, Paul says to them, God is now proclaiming to mankind that all people everywhere are to repent, because he has set a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all people by raising him from the dead. Now he brings them into connection with the history of Judaism, which is a Messiah, and then makes claims that this Jesus is this Messiah. He doesn't mention the Word here, but that's what he's getting them to. So do you see him taking them where they are and bringing them to the historical event of the resurrection and opening the door to this God that gave the Messiah to the world? Now it's almost as though he's saying, you Greeks, you reason to this point, and now I want to show you what's been going on here, and I want you to use your reason, continue to use your reason, but recognize that there is a historical path with the Jews that culminates in this Messiah, and that Messiah then becomes the God, the unknown God, that you really do need. And there are a whole lot of facets to that Jewish truth, that Jewish history. Does that make sense? So what we're looking at in Western civilization is not just an amalgam of reason and revelation. What we're looking at is reason and revelation put in right relationship to each other biblically, and then embodied in the faithful human being called Paul, and then preached to the world so that it could be understood by both Greeks and Jews. Dick just mentioned how Paul says at one other point that there's neither Jew nor nor Greek, and that the two of them actually were very unhappy with each other in many ways, and it's true. And you even see it later on in Acts, the problems that the Jewish converts and the Gentile converts have with each other. Some of the Jewish converts want the Gentile converts to be circumcised, for example, to pick up on all the Jewish traditions and so on. And they have debates about all that. What do we need to do? What's superficial? What's necessary? What's not necessary to become a Christian? How do we bring these two sides together in a way that is glorifying to God? And that's the problem. Now, what we've got in modern history, well, let me just speed through the next 1,500 years or so. From the time that the church is being born in that first century to the end of the Roman Empire is about 400 and something years. 476 AD is when the Roman Empire fell. But by 313, you have the Edict of Milan that ended the persecution of Christians. So Christians were persecuted from the time of Paul all the way up until Constantine in 313, 312 really, but 313 was when the edict was laid out. And between 313 and 394 or so, Christianity was acceptable, but in the latter part of the 4th century there, 394, you get an edict from Rome that says if you want to be a Roman citizen, you have to be baptized. You have to be a Christian. So within 100 years, it changed from you can burn them at the stake, you can crucify them, you can serve them to the lions, Christians can be persecuted, to saying just exactly the opposite, not just tolerance, but you must be a believer if you want to be a Roman citizen. And from that point on, we had what they called the Holy Roman Empire. Now, as you know, that didn't go over very well. Because I think if you think about it for a second, somebody comes along and says, here's a baptismal font and here's a sword. Which one would you like me to use on you? You say, well, let me think about it, the baptismal font. There's not much thinking to do, is there? But what it meant was that it diluted the church in many ways. People then became Christians in name only, if you want to think of it that way. Okay, well, here we have then the end of the persecutions, the establishment of this Holy Roman Empire in the 390s. But by 476, the last emperor has abdicated and Rome is over. So it isn't even 100 years between the time that they become Christians in name only to the time that the Roman Empire disappears. And what we're left with is a dark ages. I still call it a dark age, but for some reasons other than what most of my history buff buddies, professors, use it. When they talk about the dark ages, a lot of times they're talking about the superstitious time when everybody became Christians. And that was the darkness, And the Renaissance is the rebirth, of reason and goodness and truth and all these things, right? Well, I want to say that's silly. That's not true. The truth is, though, that you can call these first 500 years or so of this time since after the fall of the Roman Empire dark for a couple of very good reasons. First of all, you don't have much in the way of archaeology digs. People during that time, the barbarians, the peoples of Western Europe, didn't build in stone. They didn't know how to build in stone. The Romans did, and they left all sorts of ruins everywhere. But the story goes that the pagans, the barbarians, would build their lean-tos, their huts and their houses and so on, with one wall against the stone remains of some great Roman building, because they didn't, not only could they not build in it, but they didn't know how to tear it down either. It was just beyond them. So what we have is a lot more information about ancient Athens and ancient Pompeii and ancient Rome than we have France in the middle of the 600s, for example. Because they didn't build in stone. We can't dig it up and look at it. Everything they built decayed. It was all built out of wood and so on. And the other reason I call it dark is that for a lot of them, writing was impossible. It's not that they didn't have language, but they didn't write things down. They had verbal language, written language. Written language is what didn't have. So they don't have a lot of books from that time. You can't read a lot. The main way we know anything about the time between, say, 500 AD in Western Europe and 950 or so is from ecclesiastical histories. Monks would write about the church during that time. The Venerable Bede is a good example. But monks would write about the church, and because they write about the church, they would write about how the monasteries worked and how the monastery related to the outside world and so on. And you get a little taste of what it's like to live outside the monasteries and outside of the history of the church. But it's really an ecclesiastical history that Bede gives us. But that's what we know about. It's not until the 10th century or so that the culture begins to build again in stone, and write books and craft music and so on. It's not that it never happened. Don't get me wrong. There are lots of interesting cultural things going on, even among the unbelieving pagans. But really, the history of the Dark Ages, from 500 to about 1000, is the history of the slow conversion of the barbarians to Christianity. That's what's going on. If you read Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, he will describe in detail what life was like in Londonium, the city of London, that was at the time toward the end of the empire Christian, and the civilization that they had there, and then in the next couple of centuries how the Saxons blew in there. Because, you know, as the Roman Empire fell, Rome pulled its fighting forces back closer and closer and closer to defend Rome. By 410, Rome itself has been sacked, which was amazing. Nobody in the history of the world had ever thought that Rome would fall. You know, that's the great power. Well, but Rome was sacked by Alaric in 410. Well, outward edges of the Roman Empire. You know, Roman Empire in the first century went all the way to Scotland. Well, they had to start withdrawing their troops, and so they were kind of left by themselves, left to defend themselves. And in the 6th century in particular, the Saxons invaded England and basically decimated the place, just tore it to pieces. If we think we know about barbarism today, just read how he describes these Saxons taking on what was civilization at the time in southern England. They killed anybody that was Christian if they could find them. They destroyed the churches. They destroyed the government buildings. They undid all the laws of marriage and inheritance and that kind of thing. So economic chaos reigned. The families were destroyed, torn to pieces, and anybody that survived who was a church leader escaped, usually to the west, what's now Wales, up in the mountains in Wales. And they became, you know, the people that were living in London were called the Britons. And when they escaped the Saxons and went up into Wales, they were the remnant of the Britons. And eventually you start getting mythologies about the king of the Britons, Arthur. You've heard about Arthur and the sword and the stone and all those sorts of stories, and Malory and White and so on. Well, they were the remnant of this Christian civilization up in the mountains, and they were trying to hold on to some sense of meaning and identity in the midst of a pagan world. Well, what happened with the Saxons, though, was the Saxons slowly became Christians. Over the course of the next 100 years or so, they settled down, they moved in, they took over, and they were slowly converted. Well, In the 7th and 8th centuries, the Danes, the vicious Danes, the barbarian Danes came. And they ransacked the place. And they went through England and took over. And they basically settled down. And when they settled down over the next 100 years or so, they became Christians. And then in the 9th century and early 10th century, you had the Vikings did the same thing. The Vikings came flying through Europe and from every direction. They were going down the Seine River into Paris. They were found in the Mediterranean, but they were also taking over what is now Great Britain. And they too slowly are converted to the faith. It's the way God did it. It's kind of a judo flip, if you will. The strength of the enemy served to overreach, you know, to go too far, and they are able to be flipped into the faithful camp. I sometimes worry, this is a little side issue, I sometimes worry that maybe God is going to do that with the Muslims in the world, and that he's going to allow them to overrun Europe and overrun even maybe this country or Western civilization down the road, because they won't listen to us and eventually become believers. I don't know. It would be a sad way to do it. It would be sad to watch our culture fall apart. But that may be the way he does it, because he cares more about the souls of people than he does, in the end, about Western civilization. Well, by the end of the 10th century, by the year 1000, a Viking named Leif Erikson is sailing from Europe through Iceland, from Iceland across to the North American continent, and he's a Christian, and he's bringing Christianity with him when he does. So by the time we get to 1000, the European world has... We used to describe it like this, that during the Dark Ages, Christians had to have a plow in one hand and a sword in the other, because they were desperate to be able to feed themselves, living in a very chaotic place, and they had to fight off the barbarians that are always trying to steal their stuff. But by the time you get to 950, you begin to see Romanesque churches being built. You begin to see... I'm trying to get history into this and doing it very quickly, so I'm leaving out a million things. But in 800, of course, there was what they call the Carolingian Renaissance. And it was Charlemagne reestablished what he called the Holy Roman Empire for a generation. He sort of divided it up amongst his kids, and they started fighting with each other, and it all collapsed again. But there was a peak where he gathered together a lot of scholars, people who knew how to teach the faith and language, and had a school, a Latin school, there in his kingdom, in his empire. Alcuin of York, is that right? Does anybody know? I think it's Alcuin of York that was his main scholar. Anyway, a Latin scholar who was able to teach writing to people again. They had to become literate. He himself wasn't, but he wanted his people to become literate. And so there was a kind of a revival of letters in 800, around 800, when he crowned himself Holy Roman Empire Emperor on Christmas Day of 800. Well, by the time you get to 950, we're at the point now where the civilization has enough breathing room, some safety, that they can afford to put the sword down and write things, to build things, to paint paintings, or to weave tapestries, or to create culture. And it turns out that culture assists in propelling the faith down the generations. And so that's why you see culture starting again then, and you have the beginnings of the Romanesque architectural buildings in the 950 to about 1100, 1150, and then in 1140 the first Gothic building is built. Abbot Suger builds his Saint Denis, and you have this eruption of culture, and you have the three great accomplishments of the High Middle Ages: the Gothic cathedral, Thomas Aquinas's Summa, and Dante's Divine Comedy. So, when they say in 1400 that there's a Renaissance in Florence, take it with a grain of salt, because there was a lot of tremendous culture in place before that time. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in the talk tomorrow, so I'll save that for then. But that's how this thing happened. It was this little by little yeast working its way through the dough of human activity in the Western world until we get to the point where the Western world is beginning to send out colonists to other places, like Leif Erikson in the 11th century, like the early pilgrims to the North America in the 16th century. Sorry, yeah, 16th. Early 17th century, sorry. The 1600s. 1620 was Plymouth. 1630 is when John Harvard arrived, and 1636 is when they founded their university. And the university was patterned after Cambridge, where they all went to school and learned their faith. And Cambridge was patterned after Oxford, and Oxford was patterned after University of Paris. And Paris was patterned after the cathedral schools of Chartres and some others, and that was the High Middle Ages. That's where the university came from the High Middle Ages. We now think of universities as purely secularized buildings and educations and so on, but the university is an invention of the Christians. So, my point is that it took the combination of Athens and Jerusalem through the faithful workings of a single preacher, Paul, to kick this off. I'm not saying it's the only way it could be done, but it's the way God chose to do it. So I don't think it's wrong at all for us to say that Western civilization, for all of its flaws, is the creation of God.